Long before the Zionist regime assault on Gaza in May, Meta was habitually taking down pages of Palestinian news organizations, often without prior notice or justification. Last year, Meta even removed the page of the health minister in Gaza, a vital source of information for people there. It was restored following inquiries from the Electronic Intifada, but the censorship does not seem to be enough. U.S. media and political elites have been demanding increasing control and censorship of social media platforms in recent years. The initial pretext was the evidence-free allegations that Russia had used social media, including Meta, to manipulate the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election to help Donald Trump win.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
There is no end in sight for the plight of the Rohingya Muslims. Already living in sprawling refugee camps that are said to be one of the most densely populated places on earth, the Muslims in the Bangladeshi city of Cox's Bazar say they are being hunted down by police and local criminal gangs alike. Following the assassination of prominent Rohingya activist Mohibullah in September, the Bangladeshi police have launched a heavy-handed crackdown on the camp residents. The refugees say the law enforcement is using the crackdown as an excuse to treat them aggressively. They allege that the police have blackmailed, extorted, and even sexually assaulted them.
There's no safety and security in the camp. And that is why anyone can come in and commit crimes. And not many people dare enough to make noise in order to talk about the gang activities or any criminal activities, because they become the target.
According to a New York Times report, the refugees are being put on a hit list by violent gangs. In less than a month, at least 8 people have reportedly been assassinated by ARSA, a large militant group that is trying to impose its own rule over the displaced Rohingya.
ARSA, the Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army. They enter the camp for years, coming in to recruit their troops or coming in and doing other businesses. And also you have drug dealers, drug traffickers who come in and making profit out of the refugees. And you also have other perpetrators who come in, prey on women and children, and or to human traffickers to abduct people to just sell them to other countries.
The menaces the refugees are facing come on top of the poor living conditions in the overcrowded shelters and inclement weather that's threatening their lives and what's left of their belongings. The United Nations and Bangladesh's government signed a deal in mid-October to work together to aid and serve Rohingya refugees on Basanchar Island in the Bay of Bengal, where more than 19,000 people have been relocated from overcrowded camps near Myanmar's border. According to the UN, the agreement allows the refugees to move back and forth between the island and the main camp in Cox's Bazar. The UN has also noted that moving to the island would be voluntary. Authorities in Bangladesh have announced that another 81,000 refugees would be relocated to the island over the next 3 months. The development comes as most of the Rohingya refugees are not pleased with the relocation and say life on the island is hard for them. The agreement has also marked a shift, as the UN used to criticize the relocation, saying the island was regularly hit by cyclones, heavy monsoon rains, floods, landslides, and other natural hazards, and was not fit for habitation. However, the Bangladeshi government claims that it has spent tens of millions of dollars on the island's development, insisting that it's no longer a vulnerable area.
Those who are in the authority, they've been informed. But then the UNHCR will be saying, oh, that's the Bangladesh government authority and responsibility to take care of the refugee security. But at the same time, you also have the Bangladesh government who is worrying that the Rohingya will be living here forever if they feel safe. They wouldn't want to go anywhere or go back to Burma.
The standards of living haven't changed much for the refugees in the past few years. They were facing murder, rape, and torture at home. The same atrocities are haunting them kilometers away in Bangladesh.
A new report by The Times has revealed detail about one of the largest civilian casualty incidents in U.S. history. On 18th of March 2019, the U.S. military carried out an attack in the town of Baghouz in eastern Syria. An F-15E attack jet targeted a crowd of people in Baghouz with a 500-pound bomb. 5 minutes later, it dropped another even bigger bomb, and then another. Initial battle damage assessments put the death toll at around 70. The Times also revealed that following this strike, the U.S.-led coalition forces had bulldozered the blast site to cover up the incident. The U.S. military didn't publicly acknowledge the incident, and the death toll was downplayed. Finally, this week, U.S. Central Command acknowledged the attacks for the first time. It said 80 people were killed in the airstrike, including 16 Daesh terrorists and 4 civilians. However, saying it was not clear if the other 60 were civilians, it justified the killings by saying women and children might have been Daesh members. The report says the death toll was almost immediately apparent to the military officials. It said an Air Force lawyer present in the operation center at the time believed the attacks were possible war crimes, but regulations for investigating the potential crime were not followed.
Well, you know, in an ideal world, there would be a prosecution, there would be a trial and a proper hearing, but the way the world is run today, it's highly unlikely that the United States will, first of all, recognize any international court, and second of all, follow the judgment of such a court.
The admission was rather unusual, as more often civilian deaths are undercounted by the U.S. military, even in classified reports. Pentagon recently admitted that a drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul on August 29th was a botched strike. It killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. The attack came amid the hasty withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and days after a suicide bombing in Kabul International Airport that killed over 150 Afghans as well as 13 U.S. service members. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group named Air Wars showed that since 2001, at least 22,679 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as over 48,300.
Well, the fact is that if the world's so-called sole superpower can flex its muscles anywhere it chooses, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of international law, and regardless of public opinion worldwide, this gives the worst possible example to American allies, and that is follow the leader. If the United States can kill people at whim, at any place, at any time, then presumably its allies can do similar things.
Pakistan, in particular, has been the victim of U.S. drone strikes. The U.S. began its attacks in 2004 to kill Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. There are questions about how many civilians have been killed as a result of these strikes. According to the highest estimates, These strikes have killed thousands of people. The U.S. military, from CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. Nearly 1,000 strikes hit targets in Syria and Iraq in 2019 using 4,729 bombs and missiles. The official military tally of civilian death for that entire year is only 22, and the strikes from March 18 are nowhere on the list. The strategic province of Ma'arib has for some time been a flashpoint of conflict between the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters on the one side and the mercenary forces supported by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. Yemeni forces have been inching closer to fully liberating the province. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, Khaled Said Batarfi, confessed that the group's terrorists have fought against the Yemeni army and fighters from the popular Ansarullah resistance movement. He said Al-Qaeda terrorists have fought on 11 fronts. Yemen's interior ministry confirmed that the Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed militants in Ma'arib, as Yemeni forces are pressing ahead with an offensive to liberate the city. However, Riyadh had denied such cooperation. The Saudi-led alliance had previously claimed it has crushed Al-Qaeda's ability to carry out attacks from Yemen. But in 2018, an investigation by the Associated Press found that the coalition has been paying some Al-Qaeda commanders to leave key cities and towns while letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and looted cash. According to the report, hundreds of Al-Qaeda members were recruited to join the coalition as soldiers.
The United States and Saudi Arabia created terrorism, beginning with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then moving these people that have been trained by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Saudis, with the help of Pakistan, to the Balkans, to Yugoslavia, destroying that country. And then again, they were rebranded when they moved into Libya and Iraq and Syria as ISIS or IS or Daesh.
The report also revealed that the United States was aware of the arrangements and prevented drone attacks against the terrorists. Add to it Washington's logistical and weapons support for the Saudi-led coalition. This confirms that the U.S. is on the same side as the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda terrorists. A CNN investigation in 2019 found that Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners have transferred American-made weapons to Al-Qaeda-linked fighters and other terrorist groups waging war in Yemen. They used the weapons as a currency to buy the terrorists' loyalty. The U.S. itself is also responsible for continually sending deadly weapons to the West Asia region. Washington is also responsible for providing them with heavy weapons. The program was a total failure and only contributed to the growth of the Daesh terrorist group and the humanitarian disasters stretching across Europe. Washington is also responsible for the creation of the Daesh terrorist group. It's also accused of transferring Daesh terrorists from Iraq to Afghanistan before its shambolic withdrawal from the country.
I would certainly think so. I mean, the United States loses weapons. That's beyond belief. I think it's a way of saying, well, we either drop them to the Al-Qaeda people in the peninsula, or we gave them to the Saudis and the Emiratis to pass on to Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. So it's basically hypocrisy, which the Americans are very good at. I think they learned it from the British. But certainly these things don't go missing. They're provided. And they're handed over. The Americans are operating in Yemen themselves, although this doesn't seem to make the Washington Post. So you're right that this is collusion and it's cooperation.
U.S. and its allies have flooded the region with weapons that have ended up in the hands of terrorists. This support for terrorists has fueled a conflict that has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and children.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise again. On Friday, Moscow said it detected 6 NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea over the span of 24 hours, reiterating its warning that it will defend itself against any threats along its borders. The Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow, as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which was reunited with Russia from Ukraine in a referendum in 2014, a move that the West deems illegal.
2014 was a defining moment. Russia stood up for itself like it stood up in 2015 in Damascus across Syria. And this is what's of most concern to Washington in their search for a unipolar world, that Russia would have the audacity, the courage to stand up for itself.
NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region, in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described on Friday as provocative the increasing NATO's activities in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes in the region.
I mean, Russia doesn't have anywhere close to the amount of U.S. military, the bases that the U.S. has surrounding Russia. Imagine if Russia had bases in Mexico and Canada and in the Pacific. The U.S. would never stand for that. So what we see on full display here is U.S. hypocrisy in the same Russophobic attitude that has characterized U.S. foreign policy for how many decades now.
The Russian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that the United States was setting up a multinational group of armed forces close to Russia's border in the Black Sea region. The Kremlin has dismissed a Western media report that said the U.S. was concerned about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, noting that Russia has posed no threats to any country.
And of course, the U.S. acting through NATO with its junior allies, constantly building up troops in Latvia, in Estonia, in Poland, across Russia's borders. So it's the Russians that have every right to be concerned.
In the meantime, the migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland is also spiraling into another regional dispute involving the West at Russia's doorsteps. Thousands of migrants have been stranded along the border for months after being denied entry to the European Union by Poland. Minsk says Warsaw is violating international asylum norms by preventing the migrants from crossing the border and greeting them with a heavy-handed response. In face of escalating military activities near the border, Belarus and Russia held snap joint military drills in the area. Russia's defense ministry confirmed in a statement that its paratroopers were taking part in the exercise. Minsk has also threatened to cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe through pipelines that transit through Belarusian territory in retaliation for any possible sanctions from the EU. It would be bad news for Europe if Belarus moves to carry out the threat, as gas prices on the continent have already hit all-time highs and are vulnerable to any possible supply disruptions.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Pregnant women in the United States die by homicide more than they die of pregnancy-related causes, according to a study published last month. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Nidhi Subraman Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Homicide is a Top Cause of Maternal Death in the United States. Stay tuned for more. Pregnant women in the United States die by homicide more than they die of pregnancy-related causes, according to a study published last month. Researchers revealed this grim statistic by using death certificates to compare homicides and pregnancy-related death across the entire United States for the first time. Although smaller studies have tracked homicides during pregnancy at the state and local level, confirming the scope of the phenomena on a national scale is valuable, says Vijay Singh, a physician at the University of Michigan Medical School in Ann Arbor, who studies how healthcare workers can monitor abuse. You can understand the problem unless you can measure it. The study results, he adds, are stunning. The researchers found that U.S. women who are pregnant or were pregnant in the past 42 days die by homicide at more than twice the rate that they die of bleeding or placental disorders, the leading causes of what are really classified as pregnancy-related deaths. Also, becoming pregnant increases the risk of death by homicide. Between the ages of 10 and 44 years, women who are pregnant or had their pregnancy end in the past year are killed at a rate of 16% higher than are women who are not pregnant. For more than 20 years, researchers have been talking about pregnancy-associated death and homicide in women, says Phyllis Sharps, a nurse scientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing in Baltimore, Maryland. The consensus, she says, is that this is happening in large part because of violence by husbands. Arrive at a national snapshot, reproductive epidemiologist Mae Vallis at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana, and her co-authors analyzed data for deaths in all 50 U.S. states from 2018 and 2019 using information in the National Center for Health Statistics database, which is hosted by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. In 2003, the United States began requiring that death certificates indicate whether a person had died while pregnant or within either 42 days or 1 year of the end of a pregnancy. By 2010, about 37 states included such an option on their certificates. By 2018, all 50 states required this information. This year, Wallace and co-workers analyzed the resulting records. According to their count, across 2018 and 2019, a total of 273 women died by homicide either while pregnant or within a year of the end of their pregnancy. When tracking deaths among pregnant women in the United States, the CDC doesn't classify homicide, accidents, or suicides as causes of maternal mortality. Wallace and others say homicides should be counted because there is indeed a connection between homicide and pregnancy. The overall rate of maternal mortality in the United States of America is on the rise, and it is particularly high for a wealthy country. Contributing factors include inadequate access to health care, staff who are poorly trained for emergencies, and subpar care given to black women because of racism in clinical practice. On the basis of years of study, specialists in intimate partner violence expect women who are already in abusive relationships to be at increased risk of homicide if they become pregnant. Wallace and her co-authors say that about two-thirds of the homicides recorded in their data occurred in the person's home, suggesting that the woman was killed by her husband. It's not a perfect indicator, Vala says, but it's all we have got in these data. The team found that black women in the United States who are pregnant or were recently pregnant have up to nearly threefold higher risk of dying by homicide than those who are not pregnant, the highest increase reported among any racial or ethnic group. Black women are similarly at heightened risk of death from obstetric causes. Overall, black women who are pregnant or were recently pregnant die of pregnancy-related causes 2.5 times as often as non-Hispanic white women, according to the CDC. Age is also a factor in pregnancy-related homicide. The team found young women between the ages of 10 and 24 are at higher risk of homicide while pregnant than are those who are older, according to the study. It's an age and race story, Wallace says. What Wallace and co-workers have done with the data available gives more confidence to the scope of the problem and the work that came before, says Aaron Kivisto, a clinical psychologist at the University of Indianapolis in Indiana who studies domestic violence and suicide prevention.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Kaid al-Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Al-Fasfus is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says al-Fasfus could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Berzelay Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if al-Fasfus or other hunger striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope al-Fasfus won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Kaid al-Fasfus, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follows the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Kaid al-Fasfus and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, al-Fasfus' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The Latika factions and the Gauls of Strib, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the Onorwa office in the Gauls of Strib to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the Onorwa. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for Onorwa, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
بالتزامن مع انعقاد مؤتمر المانحين في العاصمة البلجيكية.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aids are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Joint Conference of Syrian and Russian Committees formed last year on Syrian refugees' return was held in Damascus. Syria's Minister of Local Administration said amnesty decrees and investment laws issued by Syria proves the government's genuine desire for refugees to come back. Officials said hundreds of thousands of refugees returned in the past years.
We formed two committees from Russia and Syria for implementing steps for refugees' return. Over 2 million displaced Syrians returned so far. Nearly 1 million of them came from foreign countries. There are 13 border crossings fully ready to receive refugees. Return of displaced resulted in dismantling 26 temporary shelters this year.
Syrian Foreign Ministry officials asserted that the government continues to repair the infrastructure and restore basic services to areas liberated by the Syrian government from terror, noting to some obstacles in the face of refugees, such as U.S. and Turkish occupation of Syrian soil, support to terrorist groups, and looting natural resources.
The Syrian government continues to take all measures for Syrians' return. Our efforts are faced by some conspiring countries' attempts to take advantage of the refugees' issue politically and exercise systematic misleading campaign that the situation is unstable, as well as lies that refugees are in danger if they return.
Russian President's special envoy told Press TV that the West started to realize they should shift their policy towards Syrians' repatriation.
Western countries were doing everything possible, and there was huge information and campaign against what has been done here, you know, and they were trying just to convince everybody that the conditions are not ready for the Syrian refugees to return. It comes to the understanding of the Western countries that they have to start to be more active themselves now. I think that's a good start. it takes, they need time, of course, because they cannot just change completely their policy.
11 agreements and one contract have been prepared to be signed between Syria and Russia in the fields of education, medicine, culture, science, and industry. The gradual restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, as well as the enhancement of economic ties with the country's neighbors, constitute a spark of hope for all Syrian refugees that their homeland started its journey of recovery from war, a fact that represents a solid encouragement for their return. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Wailing and crying, seeking the dead body of their beloved son, the relatives of Mudassir Gul, a doctor by profession, was killed on Monday, along with other civilian and two fighters, during a gun battle in Srinagar.
Authorities say he was involved with fighter and killed in crossfire. We know he was an innocent. Now that he is dead, at least return his dead body. The police have denied us his last rites.
The military operation took place on Monday evening in Srinagar, the main city of Muslim-majority Kashmir. According to police reports, the fighters had holed up in a building in the Hyderabad area and were eliminated by the government forces. The Inspector General of Kashmir Police, while talking to the media, said,
"The building owner was killed in a crossfire, while the fourth person was an overground worker, OGW, who was provided his rented space to Haider, foreign fighter, for using the same as militant hideout."
The building owner's daughter, however, accuses the government forces of using his father as a human shield.
"Security forces took my father inside the building, not once but thrice. On the third turn, he did not return, and they say he was killed in crossfire. Now that they have killed my innocent father, they must return his dead body."
The police chief said, fearing law and order problems, the dead bodies were not handed over to the families for last rites.
"It is not sure whether a militant bullet or the bullets fired by forces hit him. It would be clear after investigations whose bullet hit him."
Following the COVID-19 pandemic protocol, the authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have denied the last rites to the families of fighters killed during the military operations in Kashmir since 2020. Dozens of fighters have been buried at far-off locations, guarded and inaccessible to families. More recently, Kashmir's tallest pro-freedom leader, Sayyid Ali Gilani's family, was also denied his last rites, something for which New Delhi was highly criticized.
Although having a decent burial is a fundamental right, here in Kashmir, it is seen as a breeding ground for anti-India sentiments and irregularities. Human rights defenders say denying families a proper funeral for their loved ones is a gross violation of human rights and a reason for unending pain for their kin. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qumi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
"Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region."
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
"Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks."
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group, which calls itself Moses' Staff, has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data, which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, 6 Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnier. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Iman Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking, just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Puriza, Liverpool.
The violence in Myanmar was not enough for us, says the desperate woman upon our arrival. She says we are calling God in every possible way, but looks like our prayers are not being heard. She has many complaints, yet she can talk about the basic ones.
There is a huge list of problems that we are facing, but the major issue is every one of us has not received free COVID vaccination, and many had to spend their own money to get those. Another major hurdle is the lack of toilets for us and shortage of water supply. With regards to food, God sends many good people to feed us almost every day.
After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar, and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing. They are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of India. But in India, they are sometimes called termites, sometimes illegal immigrants. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, sounds like an encouraging phrase. But looking at the living conditions of these refugees leads one to ask question whether the world has abandoned its responsibility towards them.
Rohingya refugees are struggling to survive in the world's largest democracy with enormous quantities of effort. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress, sometimes detention in midnight raids, sometimes their camps being mysteriously burnt down. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence.
Since our camp was razed down by fire, we have relocated to this place, and it's a very difficult situation in terms of living in crumbling space. We are having shortage of water supplies. A tanker arrives and it finishes within an hour. Another major issue is snakes on this land and the lack of toilets for women.
Official estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived. But over the last few years, a vicious campaign against their expulsion is haunting the community.
In an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khalid Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leaders' confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the Al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in Al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's Interior Ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied.
The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Indigenous peoples came to COP26 summit in Glasgow with clear goals that we wanted to see reflected in the final results. Now that it is over, we don't see the path forward we were hoping for. There is still too much wrangling between the developed and the developing countries, with the developed nations blocking much-needed agreements on rights and funding. And overall progress towards implementing the commitments made in the Paris Agreement is too slow. The article you're about to hear has been written by Victoria Tauri Corpuz, the director of Tepteba Foundation, Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education in the Philippines. It has been published in the opinion section of the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled Indigenous Peoples Had a Clear Vision for COP26, but it has not been delivered. Indigenous peoples came to COP26 in Glasgow with clear goals that we wanted to see reflected in the final results. But now that it is over, we don't see the path forward that we were hoping for. There is still too much wrangling between the developed and the developing countries, with the developed nations blocking much-needed agreements on rights and funding. And overall progress towards implementing the commitments made in the Paris Agreement is too slow. We wanted to ensure that the decisions included the need to respect human rights, including indigenous peoples' rights, in undertaking adaptation, mitigation, and loss and damage measures to deal with the immediate effects of the climate crisis. We also wanted COP26 to adopt the local communities and indigenous peoples platform, as agreed by the Facilitative Working Group, an initiative that would ensure indigenous peoples and their knowledge would be included in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change process. It is vital that indigenous peoples are able to directly access finance, so that when they undertake actions on the climate crisis, it is from a position of strength, and they are ensured the protection of rights to own, to control and manage territories, especially their forests. It was also our view that Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord on market and non-market mechanisms for emissions trading and offsets should include us when these are designed and implemented, and our rights should be protected. Also, that an international grievance mechanism be established, which we can use in case our rights are violated in the implementation of Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord. I'm happy to see the preamble of the COP26 cover decision states that parties respect, promote, and consider their respective obligations on human rights, the right to health, the rights of indigenous peoples. This decision also recognizes and acknowledges the important role of stakeholders, including indigenous peoples, in averting, minimizing, and addressing loss and damage associated with the adverse effects of climate change. The decision also recognizes the importance of protecting, conserving, and restoring ecosystems to deliver crucial services, including acting as a net carbon sink, reducing vulnerability to climate change impacts and supporting sustainable livelihoods, including for indigenous peoples and for local communities. when several countries and philanthropic donors committed $1.7 billion to indigenous peoples to protect their forests, I voiced my hope that these resources would be effectively and directly accessed by indigenous peoples and not go through intermediaries such as states or the big conservation organizations. A protocol was adopted, which, if effectively implemented, means indigenous peoples and local communities will be able to further develop and strengthen the use of their traditional knowledge, practices, and innovation on climate change mitigation and adaptation. That decision emphasized the important role of indigenous peoples and local communities, culture, and knowledge in effective action on climate change, urging parties to actively involve indigenous peoples and local communities. Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord on market and non-market-based mechanisms for mitigation mentions the need to respect indigenous peoples' rights, but does not mention the need to obtain our free, prior, and informed consent. We hoped for an international grievance mechanism, but that was downgraded. So some good was done in Glasgow, but there were many inadequacies, such as the agreement to phase down rather than phase out coal production, even if it was an advance to see coal mentioned for the first time in a COP decision. The biggest coal producers and coal users, such as China, the United States of America, Australia, and India, also did not sign on an earlier pledge to end the use of coal power. With this, it is difficult to imagine that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise goal will be achieved. What we need is for countries who are contributing most to greenhouse gas emissions to be serious in cutting back on fossil fuel production. For us, in developing countries, the capacity of our government to adapt and mitigate is directly dependent on the provision of finance from the rich world. And yet, the commitment to deliver $100 billion every year from 2020 was not reaffirmed. We, the indigenous peoples, will continue to do our duties and fulfill our obligations to Mother Earth and to our future generations. But we will be able to do these much better if our collective rights to our lands, to our territories and resources, to culture and to our traditional knowledge, practices and innovations are respected and protected. Many lives of indigenous leaders and activists have been sacrificed, nurturing the ecosystem the world needs. COP26 summit didn't do enough to set us on a clear path to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise or to allow vulnerable countries and vulnerable people to adapt to the ongoing crisis.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The enemy's efforts to promote the idea that Islam should not interfere in matters related to anything besides the individual.